Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 549, titled The Pan-Turkist Movement, the Underground Reich, and the Earth Island. This is being recorded on April 23rd of the year 2006. We're going to continue with an ongoing analysis of a number of events that include, among other things, the Dalai Lama and his milieu. And beyond that, a group of ethnic entities, I guess one could say, which taken in combine, and it appears that that's exactly what's taking place, appear to form a phalanx for covert action, which is aimed at, in part, splitting off parts of Russia and China and establishing them as, quote, independent, unquote, states. They'll actually be puppet states for various corporate interests, including the petroleum industry and the Underground Reich. But to the use of these various, quote, unrepresented nations and peoples, unquote, and we're going to take a look at an organization called the UNPO a little bit in this broadcast and at considerable length in future programs. One of the things that appears to be at hand here is an attempt at controlling Central Asia. Now, in the past, we've spoken about the Earth Island. That is a concept that geopoliticians, both British and to a greater extent the Germans, saw as an entity which had to be controlled. The Earth Island was a term that the British and German geopoliticians applied to a vast stretch of landmass that begins with the Straits of Gibraltar, goes all the way across Europe, encompasses most of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, India, Pakistan, and China. If you take a look at a map or a globe, that is one giant stretch of land. It contains most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's mineral resources, including and especially petroleum. And if you look right across the middle of it, stretching roughly from the Balkans through the Middle East, across much of the former Soviet Union, parts of China, Pakistan, and parts of India, one sees a vast stretch of Muslim population. The German geopoliticians, and to a somewhat considerably lesser extent, the British geopoliticians, saw control of or alliance with that Muslim population as a key to world domination because it afforded control of the Earth Island. And one of the central elements in their approach was that it was necessary to control Central Asia, in particular the areas between Russia and China and around Russia and China and India. If you look at those giant countries, of course, when they formed their theories, India was not an independent country, but it was seen as key to controlling Central Asia in order to prevent an alliance of Russia and China, and also to keep basically India free from their influence. Well, of course, India is now a separate country and a growing power, and China and Russia are no longer communist. China is in name only at this point, but they are two growing powers in the capitalist world. In particular, Russia with its energy resources and China with just about everything are rising stars on the horizon of international commerce and capitalism. One of the things that is taking place appears to be an attempt at splitting off parts of what are now Russia and China. We've spoken in the past, and we'll speak again, of the apparent deliberate promotion of Islamist elements in Chechnya in order to basically break that key part of Russia off and to perhaps deny Russia physical access to the Caspian. One of the things that we're going to be looking at here in this program is an attempt at establishing Xinjiang province of China as a separate entity called East Turkestan. I mispronounced that, actually. I called it East Turkmenistan. It's actually East Turkestan. And as we're going to see, this province of China, again, Xinjiang province, is the target of covert action by not only elements of the Underground Reich associated with the old Habsburg royalty interests, but also there appear to be some elements of what at least nominally are U.S. intelligence involved with this effort. Now, Xinjiang province has a large Muslim population. They are called Uyghurs, U-I-G-H-U-R. I've spoken about that in past broadcasts, including For the Record 400. And the Uyghurs, other broadcasts as well, the Uyghurs are Muslims. They are, to a large extent, of Turkic extraction. And there are Uyghur elements that are involved with the Muslim Brotherhood slash Al-Qaeda milieu. And there are also Uyghurs who are associated with attempts at secular attempts at breaking off Xinjiang province. Now, Xinjiang province, not surprisingly, not only is rich in mineral resources, but it has a lot of, surprise, surprise, oil. And it appears that there is a distinct effort at promoting the, quote, independence, unquote, of Xinjiang in what is really a classic application of traditional geopolitical theory: control Central Asia, weaken China and Russia, prevent them from hooking up, and, of course, as everyone knows, get your hands on that oil. And in our past two broadcasts, we've been taking a look at the milieu of the Dalai Lama. Once again, one should avoid chauvinism or stereotyping. I'm in no way casting aspersions on Buddhism when I discuss a fascist element within Buddhism, and it appears that the Dalai Lama is associated with such an element. Any more than when one talks about the Muslim Brotherhood, one is characterizing Islam as fascist, or when one talks about the Vatican links to fascism, one is characterizing Catholicism or Christianity as fascist, or when one talks about some of the Likud and fascist elements within the Zionist movement, one is characterizing Judaism as fascist. That is not true. Once again, I want to repeat for the purposes of the present discussion, an observation by Christopher Hitchens that is very, very relevant here. This is from an article about the Dalai Lama by Christopher Hitchens from Salon Magazine of 1998. Hitchens observed that, quote, "The greatest triumph that modern public relations can offer is the transcendent success of having your words and actions judged by your reputation rather than the other way around. The spiritual leader," unquote, of Tibet has enjoyed this unassailable status for some time now, becoming a byword and synonym for saintly and ethereal values. Well, in fact, it appears very much as if the Dalai Lama, whatever goes on between his ears, is certainly deeply involved with a covert action milieu, and he has certainly maintained close relations with raving fascists over the years, including his mentor, a former SS man, the recently deceased Heinrich Harrer, another veteran of the SS Tibet expeditions, a guy named Bruno Begier, who was a war criminal. He liquidated people at Auschwitz. Harrer and Begier were called to a conference by the Tibetan government in exile and were cited by that entity, which sort of included them to a certain extent, as experts who testified as to the sanctity and independence and a wonderfulness, so to speak, of the pre-Chinese invasion of Tibet. In all of this discussion, I don't want to be misunderstood in any way as holding a brief for the Chinese communists or the Cultural Revolution or Maoism or anything else or the current abuses of the Chinese regime. That is not the case. One need not have been an advocate for Stalin to have wished for a victory, for example, by the Red Army at Stalingrad to beat Hitler. When one is dealing with fascism, it is not a bipolar concept. But nonetheless, the Dalai Lama has maintained some really insidious connections over the years with people like Shoko Asahara, the aforementioned SS veterans Harrer and Begier, other SS war criminals, as we looked at in For the Record 547. And indeed, the brand of Tibetan Buddhism practiced by the Dalai Lama lends itself rather readily to a fascist, chauvinist, and militant sort of Buddhist jihadist construction. We're going to take a look in this broadcast at the Pan-Turkist movement. What we're going to sort of do is we're going to sort of Dalai out. The camera's going to Dalai out, and we're going to get a wider angle view of the milieu in which the Dalai Lama exists. And we're going to take a look at the Pan-Turkist movement. In order to do this, we're going to go almost 20 years. In fact, we're going to go 20 years into the past. We're going to review some segments of RFA 14, recorded in January of 1986, and RFA 21 from May 29th of 1986. And we're going to take a look at some of the political history of the Pan-Turkist movement. By way of launching into, before I get into the substance of this discussion, I can't stress strongly enough that listeners get in the habit of using the written descriptions to these programs. As I've said before, if you're only listening to the program, if you're only using the audio material, you're missing a large part of the For the Record experience. Within a week or two, sometimes more, but usually within a week or two of the original airing of the programs, the For the Record programs, I turn each program and each For the Record show into a long article-length description. People have inquired about transcripts. I don't do transcripts per se, but in many ways, the descriptions for most of the programs anyway are very close to transcripts. The text that I read is there. I often include material in the descriptions that I did not have time to put in the original program. So if some of the things that I say may sound incomprehensible, obscure, impenetrable, and also occasionally I do make a mistake that I correct in the descriptions, please use the descriptions. I think this series of programs dealing not only with the Dalai Lama, but with Earth Island covert action, including the Pan-Turkist movement, exemplifies the necessity of using the descriptions. Someone who fell prey to the pitfall cited by Christopher Hitchens, namely that modern public relations offers the transcendent success of having your words and actions judged by your reputation rather than the other way around, and noting that the Dalai Lama has been the beneficiary of just such a situation. Wayne Madsen, a former naval intelligence agent and turned writer and commentator, fell victim to this in an article that he published in Counterpunch, the newsletter of Alexander Coburn. Counterpunch of August 29, 2002 contained the following article by Wayne Madsen called Bush's Bizarro World. I'm going to read this and then expound upon it at some length. Superman comic book fans will fondly recall the topsy-turvy Bizarro World, a planet shaped like a cube where everything happened backwards and nothing made sense. Welcome now to the Bush World, where the revered Dalai Lama of Tibet may now be branded by the United States as a fellow traveler, unquote, of terrorists, or, worse yet, an enemy combatant, unquote. On August 27th, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, a shadowy ex-Special Forces officer who has been linked to everything from heroin smuggling in Burma's Golden Triangle to smuggling weapons to the Iranian regime of Ayatollah Khomeini, met with senior Chinese officials in Beijing. According to Reuters, Armitage, representing the world's second-largest totalitarian regime, told the leadership of the world's largest one that the State Department had added a new group to its list of foreign terrorist organizations, the movement seeking independence for western China's Xinjiang region, an area that Chinese Uyghur, pronounced Uyghur Muslims, regard as East Turkestan or Uyghurstan. The only problem with this designation, obviously designed to please the Chinese regime prior to the upcoming October summit in Washington between Chinese Vice President Hu Jintao and President Bush, is that the new, quote, terrorist group, unquote, is a member of the same non-government organization as the Dalai Lama's Tibetan government in exile, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, or UNPO, officially recognized by the United Nations as an international human rights organization. UNPO has its headquarters on Eisenhower Lawn, named for a notorious 50s Pinko U.S. president in The Hague, and regional headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Tartu, Estonia. In fact, Erkin Alptekin, East Turkestan's exiled leader, serves as Secretary General of UNPO and thus represents the Dalai Lama and other ethnic and tribal leaders of 52 members of the organization. The Director General of UNPO, hardly a terrorist, is Karl von Habsburg of the former Austro-Hungarian royal family. Last September 12th, Alptekin, America's newest, quote, terrorist, unquote, stated in a letter to President Bush, quote, UNPO is greatly shocked and saddened by the immense destruction, injury, and loss of life which have occurred in New York, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere in the United States as a result of deadly acts of terrorism, unquote. But Alptekin's movement has been tossed into the same category as Al-Qaeda and Hamas, and its Tibetan and Chechen allies now risk similar treatment at the hands of a U.S. administration that could be legitimately ruled by any psychiatrist as clinically insane. East Turkestan is represented internationally by a number of organizations now being linked by Armitage to terrorism. They include the Eastern Turkestan National Congress, based in Munich, Germany, and affiliated groups in Istanbul, Turkey, Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, Almaty, A-L-M-A-T-Y, I don't know how that's pronounced, Kazakhstan, and New York. With Armitage's announcement, all these Uyghur groups face sanctions and deportation. Well, the presumably well-meaning Madsen here has fundamentally missed the boat about these associates of the Dalai Lama. Again, he's judging the institutions here and as we're going to see, the East Turkestan movement, part of the Pan-Turkist movement, by the Dalai Lama's reputation. Rather than actually examining the Dalai Lama's many SS and fascist connections, his long-standing relationship to the CIA, something that's quite well known, and who knows, perhaps Madsen is aware of that. And in fact, the people involved here, the institutions involved here, appear to be part of sort of the new covert action paradigm. Covert action since the end of the Cold War has often been centered in non-governmental organizations, many of them with progressive-sounding names, such as the Movement for the Independence of So-and-So or Peace in Such-and-Such, whereas in fact what they're actually doing is promoting the opposite. The aforementioned Erkin Alptekin, the son, by the way, of Issa Yusef Alptekin, for whom numerous municipal places in Istanbul are named, is a key functionary of the Pan-Turkist movement. He is also, as we looked at in For the Record 548, and as we will review right now, a member of the board of directors, a key member of the board of directors of the Dalai Lama Foundation. From the Dalai Lama Foundation's website, Erkin Alptekin is described as follows. Erkin Alptekin is one of the foremost human rights advocates for the Uyghur people of Eastern Turkestan, known as the Xinjiang Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China. Mr. Alptekin was employed by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty from 1971 to 1994. He is one of the founders of the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, UNPO, and currently serves as its general secretary. Another key member of the Dalai Lama Foundation is Michael Van Walt. Michael Van Walt currently serves as executive president of the Peace Action Council and legal advisor to the office of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. From 1991 to 1998, Dr. Van Walt was general secretary of UNPO, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. Dr. Van Walt holds law degrees from Europe and America and is currently adjunct professor of international law, Golden Gate University School of Law, San Francisco. Yet another UNPO functionary or official on the board of the Dalai Lama Foundation. Now, we're going to very quickly review some information from past broadcasts from the South Asia Analysis Group, paper number 499, titled The U.S. and Terrorism in Xinjiang, authored by B. Rama from July of 2002. This is in the descriptions for both, For the Record 540. But it is in the description for 547, which will soon be up, and will be in the description for 548. We see the following about Erkin Alptekin and the Dalai Lama's milieu. And this is not from the bizarro world of the Bush administration, but rather from elements associated with Indian intelligence. And I want to note here, too, that one of the interesting aspects of the Bush administration is that it appears that at times, and this is one of them, they've actually, by mistake, gotten something right. Indeed, it appears very much as though elements of the East Turkestan independence movement or liberation, unquote, movement are associated with terrorism, and beyond that, fascism, and the Dalai Lama himself is part of this milieu. Again, whatever goes on between the man's ears, and I wouldn't hesitate to guess at that. Reviewing from this B. Rahman paper from the South Asia Analysis Group, not part of the Bush bizarro world, India should have reasons to be concerned over the Dalai Lama's hobnobbing with the pan-Islamic elements in Xinjiang. One cannot avoid suspecting that the influence of these elements must have been behind his participation in a conference organized in Chennai last year by some elements which have been acting as apologists for General Pervez Musharraf, the Pakistani military dictator, which was attended by a representative of the Hurriyat of J&K and a large number of Pakistanis, some of them retired Pakistan military officers. The Dalai Lama's setup subsequently denied or played down some of the controversial remarks attributed to him at the conference. The government of India should consider conveying to the Dalai Lama its unhappiness and concern over his association with pan-Islamic elements in Xinjiang. Now, other elements of this paper that we looked at in For the Record 547 and 548 have specifically identified elements of the Islamist Uyghur movement as associated with the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda milieu. Now, there are other elements as well. Noting here, again from this paper, just as in J&K, in Xinjiang too, there are two distinct terrorist extremist movements, one resorting to violence on ethnic grounds to assert the Uyghur ethnic identity against the perceived Han Chinese domination, and the other using religious and pan-Islamic elements to justify violence for the establishment of an independent Islamic state. While the ethnic separatist elements have been the beneficiaries of sympathy and support from the Dalai Lama's setup and the Tibetan diaspora abroad, as well as the U.S., Taiwanese, and Turkish intelligence services, the religious fundamentalist elements have been in receipt of support from the Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI-backed jihadi organizations in Pakistan, the Taliban, and bin Laden's International Islamic Front for Jihad against the USA in Israel. In the 1970s and the 1980s, the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA had built up a network of contacts with the Uyghur separatist elements and some of those who had in the past worked for the Munich-based Radio Liberty of the CIA, such as Erkin Alptekin, chairman of the Europe-based East Turkestani Union and a close Uyghur associate of the Dalai Lama, are now in the forefront of the ethnic separatist movement. So again, note that for once, elements of the Bush administration appear to have gotten something right in spite of themselves. I suspect that this, rather like the initial crackdown by the Bush administration on the Al-Taqwa network, which they subsequently helped to subvert, they subverted their own crackdown. I suspect that elements within the intelligence community who were actually shooting straight channeled this up the line, and again, in part to curry public relations favor with China, Armitage and company went along with this. What they did not realize is that there are other elements of U.S. intelligence, or what are at least nominally U.S. intelligence, probably associated with the underground Reich and the petroleum industry, which are working with these very same elements, rather like the kind of divide we saw in connection with Bank Al-Taqwa. What we're going to do now is to take a look at the political history of the Pan-Turkist movement, and specifically, we're going to take a look at the use of the Pan-Turkist movement, which aims at uniting all of the, quote, outside Turks, those Turks living outside of the physical nation of Turkey in a Pan-Turkist empire, for political purposes. Specifically, we're going to take a look at how a pre-World War II anti-communist network called the Promethean League used the Pan-Turkist movement against the former Soviet Union, parts of which contained Turkic populations. The following is excerpted from RFA program number 14, recorded in January of 1986. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Just to show you how some of these elements are continuous to the present day, following article comes from the Arizona Republic, research credit to Ted Rubenstein. This from the Arizona Republic of January 30th, 1983. It's a story headlined, CIA allegedly has data on Pope attacker. This is by Robert D. Kaplan of the Cox News Service, Dateline Ankara. This country's most respected authority on terrorism said in an interview that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency had its own agent, an ethnic Turk born in the Soviet Union, working immediately with right-wing Turkish militants close to gunman Mehmet Ali Aja, who was convicted in the 1981 shooting of Pope John Paul II. Ugur Mumcu,
An author, journalist, and former law professor, said Ruzi Nazar, R-U-Z-I-N-A-Z-A-R, a Turk who defected from the Soviet Army in World War II and was recruited by the CIA after the war, was successful in penetrating Turkish fascist circles in the days when Aja worked as a hired gun for the National Movement Party, a leading right-wing organization. Mumchu said that Nazar, a man now about 60, was born near Tashkent in Soviet Turkestan and is believed to be living in Bonn, West Germany with his West German wife. According to Mumchu, Nazar is retired from active service with the CIA. Although the CIA and the U.S. government are saying nothing for many obvious reasons, the CIA absolutely has to know things about Aja of its own accord, which nobody else knows, Mumchu said. Concerning Nazar's ties with Turkish right-wing circles, Mumchu said, quote, in a letter to MHP, National Movement Party leader Alparslan Türkeş, that's the fellow we looked at in the 1944 pro-German demonstrations, a letter that I have seen, a friend of Nazar, Enver Altalay, wrote about Nazar's influence in right-wing Turkish student groups in West Germany. Mumchu said Nazar's CIA links have been verified by a Turkish general who maintained close contact with Nazar. Nazar was in close contact with the MHP leader at the same time that Aja and Musa Serdar Celebi were, Mumchu said. So, according to the top Turkish expert on terrorism, an ethnic Turk born in the Soviet Union, captured by the Germans, who then fought against the Soviet Union during World War II as one of these Turks who fought with the Wehrmacht, then jumps to CIA after the war, is apparently very close to Alparslan Türkeş, head of the fascist National Action Party, and again, a man, as we saw, who was arrested in 1944 while attempting to persuade Turkey to come into the war on the side of Germany. And to show you just what Ruzi Nazar is doing today, Nip Tuck is going to read you a short section from a new Village Voice.
Just this short section? This one here?
Yeah. Okay, unless good. You want to read the rest of it there.
I think time-wise, we can probably get back to that other stuff later, and we've talked about a lot of it. Let me just read you a very short segment from this Village Voice article for the newspaper week of December 31st, 1985. We've mentioned this article before. It's an excellent article on some of the latest developments on the assassination of the Pope and the beginnings of the crumbling of the Bulgarian story and the revealing of the stuff that we've been talking about all along, which is the involvement of numerous right-wing groups in this attempt on the life of the Pope back in 1981. Anyway, just a short segment to let you know one of the things that Ruzi Nazar, who Dave was just reading you about, is up to these days. Friend and colleague of many of Mehmet Ali Aja, the would-be assassin's friends and colleagues. Again, reading from the Village Voice article by Martin Lee and Kevin Coogan from the December 31st, 1985 issue. Again, speaking of Ruzi Nazar, the gentleman that Dave was reading about. Ruzi Nazar, a friend of National Action Party Chief Colonel Alparslan Türkeş, continues to play a leading role in the ABN. This September, Nazar represented the ABN at the World Anti-Communist League Convention in Dallas. So, WACL delegate Ruzi Nazar, intimate of the circle surrounding Mehmet Ali Aja. So, as I mentioned, not only do they kill people all over the rest of the world, Jews in Russia and Eastern Europe, and communists and Democrats in Latin America, and just about everybody in Korea and Japan and China during World War II, but they also shoot popes. And these are the people whom, as I said, Ronald Reagan said, God bless you, go and do your work.
That again from RFA number 14 from January of 1986. Inside 2, we're going to go back to 1986 again, and you're going to hear an excerpt from RFA number 21. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 549, The Pan-Turkist Movement, The Underground Reich, and The Earth Island, being recorded on April 23rd of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.